Let's continue with our study in this general topic, which I've entitled Toward a Radically Christian Counterculture. And I'd like to begin today by defining some of the key terms that we are considering. And first of all, I suppose it's necessary to define the terms that are part of the title of this series, A Radically Christian Counterculture. And to understand, of course, what a counterculture is, we must first identify what we mean by a culture. And in this lecture today, we will be talking about culture and seeing how there are areas of life which we call culture, which often remain largely untouched in the process of personal discipleship, or at least the public discipleship that goes on in many churches. Many churches are quite content to convert people. In fact, some churches are even content to not do that. But better churches, at least, are interested in getting people converted, getting them saved, making sure that their name is on the register in heaven and that when they die, they'll go there. But in my experience, there have been very few churches that have really devoted themselves to the task of what Jesus said we are to do, which is to teach, to make disciples, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever Jesus commanded. And when one really actually makes that their goal and sets out to do that, to teach and disciple by applying what Jesus said to every area of life, a revelation comes to the person who endeavors through this that, you know, the teachings of Jesus cover every area relevant to our relational and cultural existence. And this is something that many people don't ever realize, it seems to me. I remember how long I was a Bible teacher before it just dawned on me. I remember many years ago somebody saying, you know, I was in pastoral ministry at this time when this happened to me. One of the other elders, I was an elder, and one of the other elders mentioned that we need to, with the congregation we were doing, we need to be concerned not only about redeeming their souls, but redeeming their business ethics, redeeming their family lives, redeeming their child raising, redeeming every area of their life, that it is not just our eternal souls that must be redeemed, it is our behaviors. And, you know, the Apostle Paul said that we must be redeeming the time. There is a sense in which we have not fully grasped, for the most part, most people in the church apparently have not, that Jesus did not just come to make sure we get to heaven. He came to make a transformation and to establish an alternative society in the earth, which is called the kingdom of God, which operates upon radically different principles than the kingdoms of this world. And it has been, of course, not entirely neglected. There are churches and there are ministers who have seen this and have worked toward this end. But I'm speaking about, generally, the state of the church in the Western world and its failure to really make it a goal to establish and to develop and to preserve and to present to the world a viable alternative cultural expression to that which the world already knows. Instead, we have usually simply sanitized slightly whatever version of the culture our own society embraces and removed from it its most gross and most offensive features and called this Christianity. And my contention is a thoroughgoing discipleship, a teaching people to observe and the subsequent observation of all things that Jesus commanded will result in an expression of culture that is radically different than that of any secular culture on the face of the earth. Although, of course, some secular cultures approximate it more than others because, of course, Western culture, for example, has had much more influence from the Bible than other cultures. But we would be very wrong to assume that Western culture, as we have known it, is somehow synonymous with a radically Christian culture. So let me first of all talk about what we mean by a radically Christian counterculture. The word culture is the starting point. Before we can talk about a counterculture, we must identify what we mean by a culture. The word culture obviously has the same root as the word cultivate. Culture has to do with what people do in a cultivated society as opposed to what people do instinctively or by biological necessity. By biological necessity, people eat and sleep and drink and procreate and so forth. And those things are not technically part of what we call culture. Culture is the cultivated group life of a group of people. And I have identified, or I have defined it in an earlier version of this series. I was pressed to come up with a definition, and I looked at dictionaries, and I found that dictionaries were of very little help in defining what a culture is. But, at least to me, I came up with my own definition, and I've given it to you in the notes. I've defined a culture as the collective values, traditions, conventional wisdom, and accepted practices of a defined community or society. Again, that's the collective values, traditions, conventional wisdom, and accepted practices of a defined community or society. I have since, much more recently, found the definition of culture from a Christian anthropologist named Paul Hebert in a book called Anthropological Insights for Missionaries. In fact, much of what I have to say here has grown from my having read his book, particularly a very helpful chapter called The Gospel and Culture. And I've gained a great deal of awareness of the whole dimensions of culture that I had not really gained before, and I want to give credit where credit is due. Paul Hebert, in his book Anthropological Insights for Missionaries, published by Baker Bookhouse, he gave a definition of culture as, quote, the more or less integrated systems of ideas, feelings, and values, and their associated patterns of behavior and products shared by a group of people who organize and regulate what they think, feel, and do, unquote. Now, that sounds like a much more complex definition. And in a sense, my definition might be as accurate, but my definition is not quite so precise. I believe that he covers all the area. My definition is somewhat more hazy. So I want to give you his definition again. It's quite similar in actual content to what I had come up with. But Hebert says that culture is the more or less integrated systems of ideas, feelings, and values, and their associated patterns of behavior and products shared by a group of people who organize and regulate what they think, feel, and do. So that's what we mean by a culture. And cultures differ from one another in many areas. But as I say, the culture is is the aspect of human society that is cultivated consciously and deliberately cultivated and passed along to the next generation from generation to generation, as opposed to that which people do instinctively or biologically or by biological necessity. So that while all people eat, different cultures eat differently. They eat different foods. They have different tastes in food. As is very clear to people who travel internationally. We might think that as Americans we have, you know, quite a variety of tastes in food. We're quite tolerant of all kinds of styles. And maybe some Americans are. I personally was not. I've traveled on every continent and eaten there. And I'd have to exclude Africa. I've not yet been to Africa. But I would say that while I had eaten Mexican food in America, when I went down to live in Latin America for a while, the food was not exactly what I was accustomed to. And my family and I, although we love Mexican food, did not find the food quite as palatable as we expected to. It was all right. Some of it was quite good. But when we were in Korea, I could barely eat some of the food. It was so hot. The kimchi is, and yet their little children eat it with relish. I don't mean they put relish on it. I mean they enjoy it. And I just became clear to me how tastes are acquired, food tastes, and of course methods of eating. The Japanese sit down on a mat on the floor. Some Americans do that these days, but typically Western culture has had us sitting at tables with dinnerware and so forth, and with our feet under the table and elbows off the table and so forth. I mean, what we consider to be good etiquette is simply part of our culture. We will eat our meals generally with forks and spoons. The Chinese will eat theirs with chopsticks, and people in some countries just eat them with their hands or put their face right down in the dish. And while biology and instinct causes all people to eat, culture basically defines how they eat and what they eat. And whatever their culture is seems so normal that it seems strange to see someone do it from a different culture differently. I remember the first time we went to Australia, and I believe in England they do this too, and we've had a number of Australians in our school, so they've mixed among us and eaten with us. People from the Commonwealth countries, I guess, I don't know about Canadians, they will take their fork and their knife, one in each hand, and they'll put their fork in the position we would think is upside down, with the prongs, you know, arched downward, and they will use their fork and their knife together to scoop food onto the what we consider the bottom side of their fork, which is on the upside, the way they hold it. And that's the typical way they get their food from their plate into their mouth. They're constantly using fork and knife together. In America, I was always taught that it's not good table manners to use your knife to scrape things onto your fork. We hold our fork the other way. But you know, these are people who have a largely similar culture to ours, and ours grew out of theirs. But we can, you know, ours has changed somehow. I've always been amazed that Americans and some people in other countries drive on the right side of the road, whereas Englishmen and Japanese and certain others drive on the left side of the road. And I never did figure, I still don't know which was first, you know, which was the first way of doing it, and why everyone didn't do it the same way. After all, the car started in one place and was introduced other places. Probably it had to do with earlier customs of where people drove their wagons on the roads, you know, and they just kind of adapted that to cars. But you can see that these are not things that people do instinctively. These are things that people do by group consensus. These are regulated behaviors, organized and regulated behaviors. And those are the kinds of things that are the stuff of culture. Now, those particular things that I've mentioned as aspects of culture, the way we eat or the side of the road we drive on, these are not the aspects of culture that mostly need to be re-examined by Christians. There is not a radically Christian version of how to transport your food from your plate to your mouth or which side of the road to drive upon. But many areas of culture, which we'll examine in this area, have moral, ethical dimensions. And Christians often have not taken complete stock of those things and the ways in which those dimensions of our dominant culture here in the West may be in radical conflict with the same behaviors that would be called forth by Christian discipleship. So I hope I've given an idea of what I mean by culture. We'll talk much more about that in this lecture, but I want to move along then to the cognate of the word culture, the word counterculture. I don't know who originally coined this word, but I myself, and I think most people, would make a distinction between the word counterculture and the word subculture. In a society like America, which is a great melting pot of many peoples, there are many subcultures. Now, people may come over here from China, and they may move into a regular neighborhood. We've got some people who own the 7-Eleven across the street, came over from Taiwan, and bought a business, and they're integrated. They're integrated into American culture, as far as I know. Now, I think at home they probably speak Chinese. In fact, I believe they do. But when they're, you know, day by day, they're doing business with English-speaking people. They're dressed in a Western style of clothing. They live in a Western style home. I haven't been in their home, but I have friends who have, and I believe they have Western style furniture and so forth. So they're basically assimilated or are seeking to be assimilated into the Western culture, and that's fine. No problem with that. There are, however, Chinese people who come over and they want to retain their Chinese culture. They want to live in the West but have their Chinese culture. Frankly, I have no objection to this either. I'm not making a value judgment of this. I'm simply observing that there are Chinese people who would move into enclaves in some of the larger metropolitan areas. And when enough of these people are there and they have their Chinese shops and their Chinese products and they speak Chinese among themselves and they do things the same way there that they're done in China, we call that Chinatown. And that is a subculture. Now, by the way, people don't have to be isolated into enclaves to be a subculture. You know, surfers can be a subculture, even though they don't all live together in some big surfer commune. They just all show up at the same place when the waves are good. You know, I mean, bikers can be a subculture. Because some of these groups have their own lingo, their own values, their own ways of dressing to identify themselves as belonging to that. There are subcultures like that in America. There are religious subcultures. We have the subculture of the Amish, for example, one of the best-known religious subcultures in America, fairly visible. is the Amish. And the reason that we notice them more is because they stand out sort of like a sore thumb in that they do not follow our dominant culture's fancy and obsession with every kind of new technological innovation. And in fact, they deliberately restrict progress in their community toward technology. They still speak their own language, which is a form of German and or Dutch or something. And they have their meetings in that language, and they have their courtship rituals and all the things their own way. They're not very much like American culture generally, and they don't care. As long as they can be in their enclave and in their community and do it their way, they are happy. And most other people are happy to let them do so. They live and let live. And this is a subculture on the American continent, North American continent. But a counterculture is a little different than a subculture. A subculture coexists within another larger dominant culture and does not totally intermix. It retains its own distinctives, but it does not in any sense impose those distinctives on the surrounding culture. Such a subculture is not like leaven in a lump. It does not spread. It does not influence. It does not attempt to. It is not part of its agenda to do so. A counterculture, I would say, is a subculture with an attitude. It is a group of people who reject the dominant culture and say there is very good reason for everybody to reject the dominant culture and to replace it with whatever it is that is their particular cultural expression that they favor. In the late 60s and early 70s, there was probably what most of us think of. When we hear the word counterculture, we're almost always thinking of one particular kind of counterculture, and that was that of the hip generation. We call them baby boomers now as they age, there were different names for them back then, but essentially the hippie movement, the radicals of the 60s and 70s, campus radicals and so forth, these people typically were challenging in a big way, more than their parents ever had or their grandparents ever had. They were challenging the assumptions of the American culture that had been passed down to them for generations from their parents and grandparents. Their parents had largely followed in the same lifestyle as the grandparents had followed into. I might as well not make it third person. I'm a baby boomer. My parents followed a way of life very similar to that of their parents. And their parents followed a way of life very similar to that of their parents. And the only differences between the lifestyles of these different generations was simply that which technology and so forth introduced to the world in general. But in general, the values were similar from generation to generation. The assumptions, the way that people made their living, the way that people sought to spend their money and so forth were basically the same. And then comes the baby boomer generation, and in a way that previous several generations had not done, these people, and I will not consider them commendable for this, it was because of rebellion very largely, but I mean there may have been some who had a slightly better motivation, but they challenged that whole cultural expression. For one thing, there was a war going on in Vietnam that many people, and you didn't have to be a baby boomer to feel this way about it, many people felt that war was crazy and unjust. And, of course, some of the hippies opposed war in principle. Others just opposed that war. But since that war was dragged out so long, and no doubt partly out of selfish interest because they were subject to draft and going to that hideous war, there was a massive upheaval among that generation, essentially saying, we do not believe in this war. We do not believe in the American, as they would say, imperialistic military effort to impose the Western way of life on the whole world. In fact, we even question whether the Western way of life is superior and whether it's something that should be followed. After all, there's an awful lot of hypocrisy in our parents' generation. There's an awful lot of sanctimonious fakery. There's an awful lot of pretense at religion, but real, immorality going on in our parents' generation. And there's and an awful lot of materialism. And, our parents' generation was the generation that had come through the Depression. They had lived without, and many of them, out of the best of intentions, determined when the days of prosperity came after World War II, They decided, my children will never be deprived. I suffered deprivation as a child. Not me, but my parents and their generation thought this way. You know, I suffered deprivation as a child. Now that prosperity days have come, I will determine that my children shall never suffer those things. They will never be without any necessary thing. But little did they know how great that prosperity would be, and how luxurious and how affluent the lifestyles would become, and how materialistic the age would become. And the hippie generation, by the way, they'd never really escaped this in their hearts. But they did see that this was not all there is. You see, the hippies were largely young people who were raised by affluent post-World War II parents who wanted to give their children all the good things of life, but they didn't know what the good things of life were. They thought the good things were material things. And so they lavished upon their children material things. And I was not raised in a rich family, but my family was middle class, and while I never thought myself to have more things than I needed when I was a child, in fact, I always wanted more than I had, I can look back and say I was pampered and had all kinds of luxury lavished upon me that my parents had never known in their childhood, and their parents had never known, and which, frankly, my children don't know in their lives. But the point here is that the hippie movement grew because they began to say, well, listen, I've got all these things, but I'm still empty. And many of these people thought, well, there must be something, a deeper dimension to life than just owning stuff. And so they began to experiment with consciousness-altering drugs and with Eastern religions. I suppose they were drawn initially to Eastern religions because they felt like their parents were Christians and Christianity wasn't satisfying them, so they started looking for religious alternatives. So there's this spiritual aspect. Anyway, to make a long story short, they began to question everything. Morality, of course, marriage, monogamy, and all kinds of stuff. So eventually this movement, and it didn't take very long, just deteriorated in a total hedonistic, self-indulgent thing that was no more commendable than the materialistic hypocrisy that their parents' generation had known. But one of the things that I would like to say about this, and making this reference back to that counterculture, is that movement, that generation, was often called a counterculture. No one called it a subculture. And the reason is because the hippies were not simply saying, I don't really want to live the way my parents did. I'm going to do something different. They were out there in the face of their parents' generation saying, you are wrong, we are right. And frankly, they weren't. I mean, they might have been right in saying that their parents were wrong about some things. The problem is that the alternative they suggested was not a right one. They didn't have any more light than their parents had. Sometimes they had less. But the fact is, what constitutes what I'm calling a counterculture is a separate cultural society that is facing and confronting the dominant culture and saying, your cultural beliefs are wrong and they need to be replaced with something better. Now, when I advocate a radically Christian counterculture, of course, what I'm suggesting is that the cultural expression that our dominant culture needs to be confronted by is a distinctly God-ordained set of cultural activities and practices. And this, I believe, has not been very thoroughly done. I don't know if it has ever been thoroughly done in American history. Perhaps it was at certain times. It has not been in my lifetime, as near as I can tell. And I think it is desperately needed. Now, when I talk about a radically Christian counterculture, as opposed to some other kind, I emphasize the term radical. Now, unfortunately, the term radical today is often thought of to mean extreme. In fact, it's even become a popular term among young people for something that's really, really cool or something that's really a mind-blowing kind of thing. That's really rad. That's really radical. In my day, radical meant extreme and often was applied to the counterculture itself. You know, it was a radical counterculture, but radical usually had to do with political views. Usually had to do with an affinity toward socialism or communism or something, a desire to overthrow the prevailing political order. It's unfortunate that the word has come to have that connotation because that's not what the word really means. The word comes from the Latin word for root. And something that is radical is, by definition, something that's attempting to go back to the root. Just as the radical Reformation, the Anabaptists, sought to go back to the roots of Christianity. They wanted to go back to a purer, more biblical expression than even Luther and Calvin and Zwingli were advocating and establishing in their domain. So when we talk about radically Christian, we're talking about not something that's not a reestablishment of the 50s culture, of the Leave It to Beaver age, where everything was nice and comfortable for Christians and their views were largely affirmed rather than ridiculed. And Christians didn't have to feel awful about being Christians and making themselves known to be Christians and feel like they would be thought of as to be lunatics. Because back in the 50s, most people believed Christianity was right even if they didn't want to practice it. Some of you people are too young to know that that was the case 40 years ago. It might seem amazing to you. You weren't around 40 years ago, and you could probably, in the society you're raised in, you can hardly imagine a society in America where almost everyone believed Christianity was right. Almost everyone believed that the Bible was the Word of God. And now, I'm not suggesting people lived as, according to those beliefs. I mean, that would be the belief that they would publicly affirm. But, of course, they were as carnal and wicked in many cases as any generation, and they were simply more covert about their violations of Christian principle. But when I was a Christian growing up in the 50s, I felt more or less, you know, like I had the honor of being a Christian, in a sense. In grammar school, in high school, I took a public stand for Christianity without any embarrassment at all. I didn't live in a society that basically viewed Christians as idiots and fools and dangerous, like the society we're in now. So lots of Christians would like us to go back to a 50s culture. But that isn't a radically Christian counterculture. Going back to the time of the founding of this nation, there's a lot of Christians today that would consider themselves part of a countercultural movement that want to go back and establish the culture of, you know, of the constitutional days, the days when the Constitution was instituted, and get back to those times. Now, frankly, I think we'd be better off if the times were like they were then. I think the culture has gotten worse and worse. And if you go back some of these stages, you're getting better than now. But it would be wrong to suggest, in my opinion, that what we see in the colonial days or whatever is itself a radically Christian counterculture. It had far more consistently Christian elements than our present society does. But it wasn't entirely dictated by the teaching of Jesus. There are many Christians who are urging that we get back to the theology of the Reformation and of the Reformers, because they believe that that was good for culture. We know that Calvin, for example, radically changed Geneva. Geneva was a Roman Catholic city, and Calvin and William Farrell together, but especially Calvin, transformed that city into a Reformed city and into a place where morality was enforced, orthodoxy was enforced, and basically it was a changed city in ways that I guess a lot of Calvinists would like to see our society become again. But that was not, if we would look at it, a radically Christian counterculture. In a place where a man who disagrees with the leader can be burned at the stake, that is not a radically Christian society. It's not even the case that we need to go back to the way it was in the days of the church fathers. But we need to go back to the days of Christ and the apostles. These are the ones who are the founders. The foundation of the church is Christ himself and the apostles and the prophets. And if we would go back, as the scripture says to do, to the teaching of Jesus, we would and follow it in all areas, then we would have what I'm calling a radically Christian counterculture. And that is something that I want to explore in the following lectures. Now, I'd like to go on now by talking about what I consider to be worth contemplating, the power, the dynamic, world-changing power that resides in a divinely informed cultural consensus. We see in the book of Acts, in chapter 2 and verse 1, that before the church began to grow, it says that the disciples were all in one place and in one accord. They had agreement among themselves. And shortly after that, there was an explosion of powerful revival activity, thousands of people being converted, but not just converted, changed in the way they related to each other. sharing their goods among each other, spending their days in prayer and fellowship and in sitting under the apostles' teaching. They began to express love in practical ways among themselves in a way that it says in Acts that they had favor with the people who looked on. Even a century later, as I think it was, one of the Roman cynics was writing about the Christians, and he acknowledged that these people really love each other. And he was not saying that as a positive, because the Romans didn't have quite the same value system Christianity does. We would see that as a compliment. But he thought it was kind of stupid that we love even the slaves equal to the nobles in the movement and so forth. And Christianity got the attention of the world for its difference in the way, not just what people believed, but the way people lived. There was a divinely informed consensus about lifestyle issues that made up a Christian counterculture in both the Jewish world and later on in the Roman world. The Bible indicates that there is power for influence in agreement among individuals. Right now, I'm aware of many individuals, Christian individuals, who are living in a way that goes against the grain of the contemporary culture. However, these people are still individual families here, there, and all over the country. They do not make up a block in some one place that is visible to the rest of the world to look upon. And I'm not saying they should all move to one place. I just believe that what they are doing needs to become done by more and more group. You've got to have, I hate to use the term that has been popularized by New Age, but you need a critical mass of enough people who are following a certain way to make it a cultural expression. I mean, what a family does, there's an internal family culture, but that's hardly worth mentioning, generally speaking, in terms of impact on the world. But when you've got a group of people who live according to certain ways that go against the norm and the stream of the culture, then you begin to have a subculture. And if they are very vocal, if they are out there saying to the world, listen, you're doing it wrong, what we're doing is right, not because it's what we're doing, but because it's what God has said, then that begins to become an influence. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, there's a well-known passage that talks about how two or three can have tremendous more influence than simply one. In Ecclesiastes 4:9, it says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? I'd say that's interestingly true spiritually as well. Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Two is better than one, and three is better still. It says in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus said to his disciples that where two or more agree as touching anything, it will be done. And indicated that although the prayer of an individual Christian has tremendous power, Jesus indicated there's something more. There's something more influential, something more to be desired by the agreeing prayer of two or more. Of course, two is a very small number. Ideally, the whole church, which is much more, should be in agreement, praying and working towards certain goals. The passage I'm talking about is Matthew 18, verses 19 and 20. He said, again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them. And this being so, should give us tremendous reason to believe that the Christians, if they would agree and act in concert and to provide a truly Christian alternative in terms of a cultural expression, that this would have tremendous potential for impact on the world. We are bemoaning the fact that the church has lost all cultural influence. And we need to get back to the point where we can influence the culture somehow. You know, the counterculture I was mentioning before, the hippies, they, in the beginning of their movement, they didn't have one rich man among them. They didn't have one newspaper that they owned or a television station. They didn't have any politicians among them. They didn't have any of the power brokers of the prevailing culture on their side initially. But they just kept keeping on. And they permeated. And to a certain degree, people say, well, the hippie movement's dead. Back in 1969, I think it was, the hippies carried a coffin full of flowers through Haight-Ashbury declaring that the flower child movement was dead. But it didn't die. The spirit of it lived on, and it's dominant. It's dominant in our culture in many respects. The morals, the drug problem that was introduced in those days has become way out of hand. Of course, it's no longer hippies using drugs as much as just down and outers, you know, a lot of times. But there's a revival even of hippie styles and hippie notions even among the young generation today. There's something very resilient and very tenacious about some of those cultural ideas, and to our detriment, they have endured and spread, and they did so because of the power of consensus, not the power of truth. They didn't necessarily have truth on their side, but they simply had agreement. It was not that there was a conspiracy. Well, there may have been, but I'm not aware of there having been one. But if there was a conspiracy, it was not so much some conspiring group of powerful people that made it happen. It was a consensus, a growing consensus. Now, that is one that was not even informed by God and did not have the power of God in it. Christians, if they had a similar consensus about the ways of God among themselves and lived out that consensus and confronted the dominant culture with those values, Jesus said, if two or more gathered in my name, I am there. What potential is there? In such a case, we have Jesus himself present and his power there to transform the environment in which we are, like leaven does to a lump of dough. I have a quote in your notes here from John Blanchard in his book, How to Enjoy Your Bible. This is a notable example of how just following the Bible, taking it for what it says and doing what it says, how this can impact a culture and a society in which this practice is begun. And in the case, the example I have to give you, only two men were Christians in this society, but they transformed their whole society. John Blanchard wrote this in his book, How to Enjoy Your Bible. Quote, some years ago, Reader's Digest carried an amazing story called Shimabuku, the village that lives by the Bible. When American troops liberated Okinawa toward the end of World War II, they found it in an appalling social and moral condition. Then they reached the village of Shimabuku, where they were greeted by two old men, one of them carrying a Bible. Suspicious of a trap, they entered the village very cautiously, only to find it spotlessly clean, its fields tilled and fertile, and everything a model of neatness and cleanliness in stark contrast to all the other villages round about. The reason? 30 years earlier, an American missionary on his way to Japan had called at Shimabuku. He only stayed long enough to make two converts, those two old men, teach them some hymns, leave them a Japanese translation of the Bible and urge them to live by it. With no other Christian contact and guided only by the Bible, those two old men had transformed their community. There was no jail, no house of prostitution, no drunkenness, no divorce. Instead, the people lived healthy, happy, fulfilled lives, an oasis of love and purity in a desert of degradation all around them. Clarence Hall, the war correspondent who wrote the story, summed up his feelings in the words of his dumbfounded driver, who said, "Maybe we're using the wrong kind of weapons to change the world." The evidence of history is that wherever the straightforward teaching of the Bible has been rightly applied and obeyed, society has undergone a moral and spiritual revolution. Unquote. Now that is a true story. And what's interesting about it is how that two people who agreed to follow the Bible in 30 years transformed their whole society. The counterculture that rose 30 years ago, which was not informed by the Bible, but by paganism and narcissism and self-indulgence, that society in 30 years transformed America into the morass that it is right now. Seems to take only about 30 years for a determined counterculture to take root and to grow, at least there are precedents to say that it can happen in so short a time. Within a single generation, things can be turned around if there is a determination to follow the Bible and what it says in every area of life. You can see that the differences between Shimabuku and the villages around were not areas of theology. I mean, certainly there were differences there too. But the differences were there was no crime. There was no divorce. There was no prostitution. These are cultural differences. And these are many of the areas where our own society needs to be revolutionized. And the church, rather than standing up and saying, we've got an answer for you here, we can fix it, the church is following dutifully after the world in almost every aspect of culture, rather than presenting a radically Christian alternative culture. Now, I'm not saying that Christianity in some quarters isn't standing up and saying, people should do it our way. The problem is, those who are saying so often are not really presenting a radically different way at all. And the world hears them speak and looks over and says, why should we do it your way? You've got as many divorces in your church as we have out here outside the church. You've got as many rebellious children and get, your kids get into drugs and get pregnant and get into gangs as often as you. You're going to the psychiatrist and the psychologist as often as we do. Why should we believe that you have something better? And it's a very good question. It's a hard one to answer. And the answer, of course, is that those churches often don't have anything better because they have not aimed at going back and letting the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of the Bible dictate every aspect of life to form an entirely and radically different cultural expression in the Christian community. Let me talk to you, we have a very short time left for this lecture. Let me talk about some of the dimensions of culture. I am indebted to Paul Hebert for this particular breakdown of an understanding of what culture is. He said there are essentially three manifestations of a culture. Dimensions of a culture. There is the cognitive, which has to do with what people know. There is the affective, which has more to do with the way people feel. And there is the evaluative, which has to do with what they approve or what the judgments they make. Now, in terms of the cognitive, this has an awful lot to do with worldview. We'll talk about worldview a little bit in the next lecture. But we, for example, do not believe in a flat earth. We live in a culture very different than that of medieval times. And we have more knowledge about the universe than they had in many respects. We certainly have much more knowledge of things like technological things and how to solve problems that can be technologically solved and so forth. And that is certainly one of the dominating informing ingredients of our whole way of life and culture. And yet a culture that doesn't know much scientific stuff and believes that, you know, all the spirits have trees and all the rocks have trees and so forth and the ancestors are still with us and we need to feed them on a daily basis. The Chinese do this, and there are tribal people who are animistic, who they have a different worldview. They don't understand reality, the basic stuff of reality, the way that another group of people do. And this worldview difference, what they know or what they think they know, the cognitive aspect of their culture, dictates much of the rest of the aspects of culture. The affective aspect or dimension of culture has to do with the way people in a certain group feel. Their feelings, their attitudes, their notions of beauty. There certainly is a vast difference in the way that some cultures recognize something as beautiful or not. Now, this isn't just cultural. This is also very largely individual. People have individual tastes, but even given the range of differentiation of individuals' tastes, within a culture there are general opinions about beauty. Now, our present culture, no offense to anybody who doesn't fit this description, I don't fit the description myself, our present culture has certain views of the ideal body shape. Mine is not an example of the ideal body shape that our culture affirms. Slender, shapely bodies are considered beautiful. You might think, well, of course, that's biological. Everyone would see it that way. Not so. Many ancient cultures, and even some modern cultures, tribal cultures and so forth, think that the biggest, fattest person is the most attractive, even in the sense of sensual arousal and so forth. Now, we maybe say, well, that doesn't go along with the taste that I had thought. But That's because you were raised differently. You were raised in a different society that affirms different things on a daily basis. You see pictures and advertisements and television personalities and movie stars and so forth who all fit a certain ideal in terms of looks. And it's a very severe screening process, you know, choosing models and actresses and actors and things like that. And most of us simply wouldn't make the grade in that cut, in that screening process. But it is a very jealously enforced standard of beauty that our culture is putting over on us, and that it doesn't necessarily agree with what the Bible would teach, and it doesn't even necessarily agree with what some other culture would think about it. I remember when I was in Germany, this would be one of my early times in Germany back in the 70s, a German pastor there who served as my translator and sort of guy who set up my speaking schedule, he said, "You Americans, you want your wives to look like baby dolls." Now, if you looked at the German wives, you could say, "Well, you Germans want your wives to look like army tanks or something," you know. But I mean, that may be true. That may be true. And there's nothing to say that the German taste is superior or inferior to American taste. I mean, American taste might be more juvenile, for that matter. I mean, maybe the German guy who wants his wife to be built like a tank, maybe he's got practical reasons, and he might be wise, you know. And if he can find that attractive, you know, the more power to him. Many Americans would not find that attractive, and perhaps he wouldn't find the baby doll type woman an attractive thing. It's a different culture. Now, I'm not sure that he represents all Germans. It may just be that his wife looked like an army tank, but because when I walk down the streets, the models on German magazines look like American models, so he may have been not speaking for his whole culture, but for himself. But the fact of the matter is, there are definitely different views of what is beautiful. And they are felt things. They're not things that someone decides to believe that. They feel that. Their culture affirms that and establishes that. Tastes in food and dress obviously differ from culture to culture. That's part of the affective dimension of culture. Likes and dislikes, the ways of enjoying oneself. Americans do certain things to enjoy themselves. You know, they might climb rock face, you know, in order to enjoy themselves, some of them. But people in another culture might just think that's a stupid waste of time and a dangerous one at that. They might be right. But cultures affirm certain things in such a way that they actually become part of the feeling and emotive part of the lives of the individuals in it. That's different than the cognitive aspect of culture, which is, you know, shared understanding of the way the world is, just sort of a knowledge, academic kind of aspect. There is the way we respond emotionally. That's cultures differ from one another that way. And then there's the evaluative dimension of culture, which is the values by which judgments are made, things considered to be moral or immoral, in relationships or the ranking of occupations, certain occupations considered high and others low occupations, or etiquette issues. It is considered in, let me think what country this is. I think it's in Japan. No, India, excuse me. It's in India. It is considered to be a sin for a woman to eat her meal before her husband does, for her to precede him in that. And it is considered in the same country to be rather rude to touch anyone or to extend, even in greeting, the left hand. Well, there's a very good reason for that particular rule, because they don't use toilet paper and that's the hand they wipe with. But so it's a great insult. But to touch somebody with the left hand or to eat before someone else. Now, those are not things that we in our culture would consider to be sinful. In some cultures, those things would be considered sinful. The Chinese would consider it sinful not to bring food to their ancestors. We don't consider it that way. Now, we might say, well, that's the difference between paganism and Christianity. We're a Christian culture. We have Christian morals. Not necessarily. The morals of the prevailing culture today embrace almost any kind of sexual union so long as it has some semblance of affection or love between it. It can be same sex, it can be man-child, it can be all kinds of horrible, corrupt things. And that's what Western society and Western culture is coming to. What we have to realize is when it comes to deciding what things are right and wrong, the evaluative side of culture, this is where Christianity is going to have more to say than any other dimension of culture, where it's going to contrast. Because what is right and wrong is determined by Christians by God's words on the subject, what God says about it. Whereas societies develop along the lines of what most people feel comfortable with or feel right about. But cultures differ from one another in the evaluative area too, in terms of what judgments they make about right and wrong, and what's good etiquette and bad manners and so forth. Now, there are various manifestations of different cultures. Behavior is one of the obvious ones, behavioral patterns. In the USA, we're taught to shake hands with people when we greet them, to eat with forks, to drive on the right side of the road, to compete with one another for grades and for success in business. In Japan, entirely different kind of culture, people are taught to bow rather than shake hands, to take off their shoes at the door, to sit on mats on the floor, to eat with chopsticks, and to assist one another in school and work rather than to compete with one another. Different cultural behaviors. And of course, if you want to multiply different cultures for consideration, you'll find a multitude of differences of those same kinds in different cultures. These are behaviors. Certainly Christians are called to behave in a very different way than non-Christians are. And not just in terms of basically keeping the Ten Commandments, as so many people would interpret the Christian duty to be, and extend it no further. Christians are to be different about the way they spend their money, the way they conduct themselves in business, the way they raise their children, the way they treat their spouses, the way they acquire a spouse, and many other cultural things that many Christians in our society don't do any of those things very differently than the world does. The way they entertain themselves, behaviors. That's one manifestation of cultures, is the behaviors of the people. Another, of course, is the products of a culture. One culture will produce canoes and baskets and clay pots and grass huts. Another will produce computers and cars and video games and things like that. You know, these are the products of a culture. Anthropologists study ancient cultures and learn much about them from the products they make. Now, I don't know that the products that Christians make are to be that much different than the products non-Christians make. I don't know that this is an area where Christian counterculture will have distinctive things to say very often. There are also the symbolic systems of different cultures, and that is language and writing and rituals. Language, you know, is symbolic. You're not really hearing thoughts. You're just hearing sounds when I speak. You're not hearing thoughts. My thoughts are in here. Your thoughts are in you, and what's transpiring between us is simply so many different sounds. To somebody who doesn't know the English language, these sounds would be gibberish and would communicate nothing, because there are no thoughts being, there's no thoughts here going out of me. But there are sounds. Now, insofar as you can interpret those sounds, that's a symbolic process, assigning meaning to something symbolic. This sound represents this concept, this word, that's a symbolic system. Languages are symbolic systems. Writing, of course, is symbolic systems. We take it so much for granted, we forget that the characters that we are reading on a page, though they mean things to us, they are simply so many marks of ink to somebody who doesn't know them. The symbols are unintelligible to someone who doesn't know the system. So the way that a culture speaks their language, I mean, there are tribal cultures that their speech is largely a matter of a system of whistles and clicks rather than articulated sounds like we're accustomed to. There are, of course, cultures that don't have any writing at all, and some their writing is more pictorial, where a picture represents a concept rather than, in our case, we have characters that represent a sound. And then you combine these sounds in such a way to represent concepts. These are different in different cultures, too, and the rituals, the courtship rituals, the rites of passage and so forth are different in different cultures. Now, Christianity actually will have something to say about some of this too. Mostly, though, where a radically Christian counterculture will challenge the dominant culture will be in the area of evaluative cultural dimension, where the decisions about what's right and wrong and the behavior that is dictated by that. Now, very quickly, I have a quote from Paul Hebert from his book, Anthropological Insights for Missionaries. He says, ultimately, the gospel has to do with values and allegiances. Jesus proclaimed the good news of the kingdom of God in which he rules in righteousness. His laws stand in contrast to those of our earthly kingdoms, and his perfection rules in judgment on our cultural sins. Jesus also calls us to follow Him. To be a Christian is to give our ultimate allegiance to Him. Anything else is idolatry. Unquote. Now, as I mentioned, culture is not something that is instinctive or biological. It is cultivated. And cultures, by definition, are transmitted from one person to another, generally from one generation to the next. A culture is of no significance at all if it only exists in one generation and the next generation doesn't pick it up. But, you know, the significant cultures are those that are transmitted generation after generation after generation. Culture is learned and therefore must be taught. Someone has said that each generation must civilize the barbarian hordes that are constantly invading it from below, meaning our own children. They are the barbarian hordes that are invading our culture. Each generation is invaded by a new group of barbarians that need to be civilized, and the adults are the ones who do the civilizing. This is the passing along of culture. And there are different methods by which the young are enculturated, or culture is passed on to them. One, of course, is through teaching. Different cultures have different ways of doing this. Some send their kids to school. Others use mentors, or others have all the teaching takes place in the home. But someone's got to be teaching, or else there won't be any learning. Also, cultures transmit their culture to the young by a process of pressing and pulling, putting pressure in two directions. One is pressure not to do what is wrong, and they use things like discipline and punishment, gossip and social ostracism and the withholding of rewards as means of putting pressure upon people to conform and not to do the things that are considered to be faux pas and misbehavior that culture dictates. On the other hand, it pulls the young generation toward the behaviors that are considered to be right in the culture by presenting heroes and role models and giving rewards and so forth for behavior that conforms to the desired norms. So culture needs to be transmitted. It's true of a radically Christian counterculture too. You may become a radical Christian, but if you can't pass this on to the next generation, if you can't pass it on to your neighbor, if you can't communicate this and teach it, if you can't confront the dominant culture and say, you're wrong, we're right, and this is why, and you can now see that we're right, and teach them, then there will be no Christian culture. If a Christian culture would arise today, it would certainly be a counterculture. But a counterculture can become more or less a dominant culture. And that would be perhaps very desirable, as long as all the people who are part of it are real Christians. But Christianity is much more attractive to the world when the world can see that it really addresses all the relevant categories of life and redeems them and improves upon them. And that's what Christianity can and should do. I'm going to have to close this session with this. We'll continue, of course, in the next lecture. But I want to talk about worldview and its role in dictating culture, and I want to talk about values, and those are going to be the subjects that we'll talk about next time. So let's end right there, and we'll continue next time with the next points.